You're listening to Federal Prison Authority Presents Around the Block with Bruce Cameron and Susan Giddings, only on LA Talk Radio.
Boom, 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 boom. Hey, everybody. Welcome to another fantastic episode of Around the Block. Federal Prison Authority Presents Around the Block. And boy, we are going to do that today in rare form.
Yes, we are.
Got a few announcements to make. Just a few real quick. Today's episode is brought in part by USP Beaumont. Back in our day, it was Bloody Beaumont. Ooh. United States Penitentiary Beaumont. Man, I was TDY there a couple of times. And, man, very memorable experiences in a place where it's just, and you worked in a penitentiary.
Susan, not a complex, but it was definitely a learning curve.
It was a learning curve.
I had transferred to the penitentiary after having worked in a camp with men, and then transferred to Carswell, working with low security and minimum security females. So to go from that environment to a USP was
a shocker.
Quite an education. I was like 10 years into my career at that point in time, so it wasn't like I was a rookie.
Right. Another announcement. What is this? This is the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers magazine, The Champion. That's what this is. A lot of federal attorneys, this is what they live and die by. What is in here? Let's see what's in here. Why? It's us. It's our book on classification. They love it so much. They say, hey, you know what? Would you be willing to run an ad? I said, sure. Why not? Spread some good word on how to write these pre-sentence or prepare for these pre-sentence reports, and so that the attorneys can understand the ramifications of these reports and how the Bureau of Prisons is going to understand them, rate them, judge them, and classify their clients after the gavel is slammed and all that good stuff. So, awesome. Yeah. All righty then. We got an action pack. Go ahead, Susan.
I was going to say, I just joined NACDL, and with you, you've been with them for a while. I just joined them, and seeing some of the questions the attorneys are asking and not realizing what the policies are and what the rules are. There was just really quickly, there was a post on a compassionate release, and several of the lawyers were kind of unhappy with the fact that at a given institution, an individual had staff members writing him letters of reference to support his compassionate release, reduction in sentence. And the U.S. attorney and the court were not happy with that. And they didn't realize that they're actually prohibited from doing that. That's actually a violation of policy. And that is not how that's supposed to work. And so they were completely oblivious. We were able to put in a link to the policy with the information. And we're actually surprised the Bureau takes it so seriously of how, you know, information is conveyed to the courts that it is actually a code of conduct issue for staff members to do that. So.
Right.
Yeah.
And I'm so glad that you're on board. So that now you can provide more real-time responses to these thread comments. And now there's two of us checking the thread comments, and we're really able to weigh in with correct, timely information. I think one of the disconnects that there were several other post-conviction experts on there. But let's just say it's been a few decades since they had been active. It's so much
updated all the time.
Yeah, so nothing wrong with that. It's just, man, you know, some of that stuff just doesn't get acted on anymore. Well, all right, enough of the announcements. Good stuff there. Glad that you're aboard. So the memo, you want to start with the memo or you want to start with the new director?
I would say let's start with the new director. His first office day in the office is today, it's good that they got a director in place so quickly. For those of who have been paying attention, there have been several periods where the Bureau went months and months with an acting director, and that creates a lot of challenges. This particular scenario. I mean, it doesn't take a rocket science to realize that the leadership right now in the Bureau at the executive level is there's a lot of blank silhouettes and not people, and needing someone to come in. I got an opportunity to see, he did a interview last summer on a podcast that I periodically check out. And just, I'm impressed with him. I think, I mean, it's going to be a big adjustment. He's coming from a state system. He's coming from a small state system, but just a real authenticity about him. Some humility that he doesn't know everything. And I think that's important coming into, you know, unless you were born and bred and brought up through the Bureau is different in a lot of ways from any state. I mean, in states, the correctional officers are sworn law enforcement, and they are completely separate from the civilian personnel, case managers, teachers, psychologists, and such. Where that's completely different in the Bureau. And there's other things that the Bureau as a federal system just does differently. So there's definitely a learning curve, but I was impressed with him. And, you know, he understands and values the importance of programming for the incarcerated population. And I also understands the importance of the staff side issues. There was a comment in one of our threads about, oh, he's pro law enforcement and anti inmate. Well, no, because if you're pro law enforcement, you're pro the system, and the system means providing programming and resources to the incarcerated population, supporting rehabilitation, and the reentry initiatives. So, I think you can be supportive of your staff and supportive of programming at the same time. The two are not mutually exclusive.
You can be a federal prison consultant and be a former BOP staff member.
And a former BOP staff member at the same time, yes. So, but yeah, no, I think it's going to be, I'm hopeful for the agency. They need some good leadership, some strong leadership, and there's a lot of things that they got to do.
Now, you just left last year, or it was last year. Do you feel that, because you know a lot of the people that left, I mean, does he have enough people around him to give him good guidance?
You know, there are a lot of good people, you know, and I mean, this is a tough time for the Bureau. I'll be really honest. I'm talking to friends, and there's a lot of stress. There's a lot of anxiety about, you know, how things are moving forward. And I think it's real easy to forget that these are people. And they've got lives and families, and this is a career that they've committed themselves to, and things are just feeling very chaotic right now. But the reality is, for him to succeed, Congress is going to have to step up. You know, when the Bureau can't compete an entry-level correctional officer and can't compete against Walmart hiring, and that's a real problem, particularly on the West Coast, where the cost of living is so out of control. Even with the locality pay, it's just not enough. And, you know, if your avocation in life is to be a case manager or a correctional officer or any of the positions, like, you can be law enforcement in the community and not coming into a penitentiary every day where you can be stabbed. You know, law enforcement on the street, you know, have a different level of support and defensive protections than our correctional officers inside. You know, if you're a psychologist or drug treatment, you know, you can go into a nice, pleasant rehabilitation therapeutic community on the street, or you can come in and run a residential RDAP program in a penitentiary. You know, it's just, it's a different world, and they've got to do some stuff with the pay structure. That's a reality.
Yeah. So we'll see what happens. I mean, yeah. Bless his heart. He's got a lot to do. And just a lot of issues out there to go through. So
absolutely.
Just hoping and praying he gets a lot of good guidance and just, you know, make some good making some good choices moving forward. I think you're right. I think there's some personality differences between this fellow and the last person. And I think that that's going to be good for everybody in the agency.
So, and there's a lot of other staff, you know, leadership. There's a lot of leadership folks who have retired or have announced their retirement. But the reality is there's a lot of good people. The Bureau's got a deep bench. They've got a lot of good people. And that fresh infusion of new blood is a good thing, both at the leadership level, but coming up through the rank and file into those assistant directors and senior deputy directors and program administrator, department branch administrators and things like that. That's good for the agency to bring in that next generation.
It is. So,
The chaos that's going on, speaking of chaos, we saw a lot of drama. We talked about the memo, which was in quite whiplash fashion, was rescinded a week later. But the interesting part to it is the problem that precipitated the memo is still there. So for those listening who maybe didn't hear about the memo, you were that person. The memo was issued jointly by the Correctional Programs Branch and the Residential Reentry Branch by the administrators, directing staff that because of resource limitations in the community, that in conducting the five-factor review, that they should be cognizant of the limitations. And they put a hard cap on 60-day halfway house under Second Chance Act, 60-day halfway house placements, or I should say pre-release placements, because it was halfway house or home confinement and or, but 60 days for everybody. And for residential RDAP graduates, 125 days, because there is, as we've talked about before in the show, there is a statutory requirement in order to benefit from the time off of the minimum 120 days. So yeah, they put that in place, and that stoked a lot of upset from all corners. And a week later, it was rescinded. But the rescission was, okay, case managers, go ahead and do your five-factor review without the community resource component. Do it just based on, the individual offender, their release needs, their circumstances, et cetera, which is great. But residential reentry still has capacity and budget issues. That hasn't gone away. So nobody should be thinking that, oh, we're going to go back to getting 6, 9, 10, 12 months of halfway house. That is an unrealistic position to be in because the problem's still there. And the problem is capacity and money.
Okay, let's just park right there. Okay, uh-huh. I got two or three calls on the way into the studio here, such as it is. Hey, they rescinded the date. Why hasn't my loved one gotten their time back? Well, first of all, they haven't done the RRC packet or whatever. They don't have an RRC date or whatever. You know what I mean? They're looking at these glorified sheets, right, with all these conditional dates. Reason, right? You still have to have the placement. You have to have a bed to get in there. So if there's no beds and things are backed up, which we know they are in many, many places, and I mean the waiting list is deep and long, right? Remember, we have people get 1 day, 1 week, 2 weeks, and they deserved months and months and months, right? Uh-huh. It's not our decision. I mean, we're just talking facts here about supply and demand. So if they rescind it, doesn't matter if the bed's not there.
Yeah.
Right?
It's not there. Now, we have seen, we did get a couple of calls today, as a matter of fact, of folks who that date came down in that week. And so, we had a couple of cases with some pretty substantial terms of incarceration They got only the 60 days. And of course, you know, we talked about the possibility of some advocating to reconsider, because under normal and usual circumstances, someone with a 15, 20 year sentence would be considered for more time in halfway house. I mean, that's just the reality. And they were drew the black card, so to speak, and their date was plugged in that week that it was in place. So, it'd be nice to say that every case manager in the agency is looking at that and, you know, going back and saying, hey, now that this is done, can you take a look at this? But the reality for case managers is once that packet is moved past their desk, they got 15 or 20 more coming.
That's right.
And going back and retreading work that's been done. And from their perspective, they're looking at, you know, and in these particular two that we talked to, they were actually given longer recommendations. The referrals were done in advance of the memo, but the processing of it came down that week.
And we had discussions, or maybe I should say I had discussions, but you were electronically there with an executive staff member. At least we got their attention enough to advocate once and probably twice, right?
Right. Hopefully they're paying attention to that. Now that one was a little bit different, but that's another problem we're seeing with the conditional calculators is not so much the conditional calculator itself. It works. But the fact that for individuals with shorter sentences, you know, they come into team and they have a good conduct time date, right? They come in, or if they're shorter, a full-term date, but most of them are good conduct time dates. They come into team. That's all they have at that initial classification, because the calculator can't run until all the needs and risk assessments and everything's plugged in. So, you know, if I'm sitting here at my initial classification with a 15, 18 month sentence, and this is my initial, my next program review is going to be in 6 months, because that's how it works. It's 6 months out. You're more than a year from release, and it's going to plug you in at 6 months. So what happens is you come to team at your initial team, everything gets plugged in. You don't get your conditional date. Maybe 2, 3, 4, 5 weeks later, whenever the next time the calculators run, you know, usually within a couple of weeks of your team, it's going to, if you have your 30 days, it's going to run your sentence comp, and it's going to run everything and go, oh, hey, give you your first 10 days. And here's the rest of your conditional. This is your conditional release date. But that conditional release date is based on what? The 10 day rate. When do you go to that 15 day rate? Next team. So, and then when the next team rolls around, right, the conditional calculator doesn't plug that new date in on your 218th day, right? 18, right? Oh, 208, I'm sorry. Your 208th day, it plugs it in when the time credit calculator runs next. So you have to pass the 208 in order to get the 15 days, and then they plug in the new date. So again, depending on when day 208 is, and when you're teamed, your conditional release date, because that's all automated so that it happens on time regardless of what happens with your team in terms of the in-person team. So we see referrals. How many referrals have we had where paperwork is done and it was right when it was done, but then things changed?
Right.
And so then we end up with folks with designation dates after their conditional release date.
They're upside down.
They're upside down, inside out, and we need to kind of reach out and try to get that situation resolved.
And we've done that. And we have done that a lot. People that were, whatever, we moved from 90 days to 120 days, understanding that stuff. And then this other thing later on, because of those changes and because the update doesn't happen until the button is pushed, right? Because all this stuff has to be earned. Not all of it's going to be front loaded by any means. Right. So then there's finally that magic day. You get your community placement, your first day in the halfway house. But then when is your real home confinement eligibility day? Right. Now that you're in a different status, if you're in the 15-day status, well, that hadn't been calculated because the home confinement date that's on there now is based on old data.
Well, and it's also based on only your earned credit.
Yeah.
So your conditional calculator includes that earned and unearned credit. And, you know, and that's something that, you know, I personally, and I know our families would like to see that, and is that that information be provided to the reentry staff as, say, a conditional home confinement date. And again, that's another planning tool. But when the
that doesn't exist on, right now, right? There's no conditional home confinement.
No, there is nothing.
It doesn't exist. It's not there.
Manually figure it out.
But who's going to take the time? Nobody.
Because it takes time.
More than us.
Yeah.
There might be a few case managers that are doing, oh, hold, let me be thoughtful. Let me actually hand calculate. Oh, wait, okay, now da 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 da.
If they don't have a horribly large caseload.
Right.
Because, again, publicly, right, the Bureau talks about shortages in correctional officers, short, and of course, everyone has shortages in nursing staff and certain shortages, but right. Case management staff is another area where, you know, having those folks in place, you know, when you're talking about the volume of work that the case managers are doing, and I did it. I was a case manager for 10 years. About 9 years. I was a case manager and then I went to a case management coordinator. And the amount of work that I had when I was a case manager just doesn't even compare. I look at some of the tools that case managers today have and I'm like, oh, if I had that, my life would have been so much easier. Because I was back in the day of, we still were using carbon at times, at least initially. We had carbonless copy forms and such. And you know, they've got more on them. They do have more tools, but they also have more data and more information coming at them at a faster pace. And they're still human beings. And if they're sitting there with 180 or 190, 200, I think my worst caseload was about 209 low security females. That was fun. You know, that's really stretching the limits of what you can do in 40 hours.
Right.
So.
Absolutely. So that's why we're here, because we help advocate and say, this is what's going on. And it's that extra nudge, because if the case manager's got them a date and got them an RRC date, that's it, man. It's just like, the same way the judge is or your lawyer. The judge sentenced the inmate, they're out of there, that's it. That's a wrap, right?
Well, how often do we hear clients say they go back to their attorney, whether it was a public defender or a paid attorney, because right. Now they're in the system and the Bureau scoring this or that in a certain way, and they're going back to the attorney, and the attorney's like, I'm done with this, you know?
Yeah.
And that's, you know, they're not thinking about that. And, right. You know, it happens regularly.
All right. And so that's a level of service that, you know, we're not doing legal services by any means, but this advocacy on knowing and us being able to understand how this works. This should be happening. This should be happening.
It's just about elevating, you know, is elevating the person's name. You know, if you are one of 150 files sitting on an RRM's residential reentry office desk to be processed for halfway house, and in between the case manager or the warden signing off and hitting the button and it being transferred, the release date changed, you know, you're looking at this information. You have no reason to believe it's incorrect. It wasn't. It was correct when the button was, when this button was pushed. But now another button's been pushed and it's changed now. But that data is a PDF. That is not a real-time data file. It is quite literally a collection of documents that's been pulled together and generated into a single PDF document. It is not a live document. So it's not like it's auto-updating internally in the referral because now this data has changed. So it would be nice. Exactly. I think that technology is a little further down the road. There's another area of shortages in the agency, computer folks, programmers. I mean, it's hard to convince a 22-year-old coming out of college that coming to work for the federal government is really cool. And you know what? You got great retirement and great health care, but, you know, we're not going to pay you a six-figure salary that some of these other private companies are going to pay you.
Right.
Because that's just not how it works in government.
So it is, it is interesting, you know, the road ahead. So, okay. So other problems that remain or?
Well, you know.
You want to go into changes?
Yeah. Cause you know, getting to what caused this, and I think about it this way. And when you and I started talking about what needs to happen, with the FSA moving forward and how do we make it better? You take a situation like we've got with this bed space and this capacity issue in halfway house. And if you get down to, you know, what's the root cause? What caused this to happen? It goes back to the FSA and some of the issues with the FSA. And some of them are conflicts between SCA and FSA, and we've talked about that, but some of it's the FSA itself. And so, you know, you and I have been working on getting the word out, and we've written some articles, and we've got some articles hopefully that we'll see published in the near future. And we've started talking about like what do we need to do differently. FSA had the potential to be really, really awesome. And for those who have released early and gone home, you know, that's great. But when you consider 65% of the population doesn't get to benefit from time credits. And that's when you sit down and you look at the numbers and, you know, in the DOJ's reports, I've been, challenged on one comment that I made on another site about the 65%. Well, you know, if you read the DOJ 2024 report that came out in June, if you read the 2024 report, like they don't make it easy to spell it out. You've literally got to add this column and put this together. And wait a minute. That's like 90,000 people,
right?
That aren't even having a shot at it either because of their offense or because they're medium or high risk. And even if that medium or high risk person works their way down, as we had a client do this past month, right?
And on the 924Cs, let's not forget about our 924C.
That goes back to, well, and 924C is interesting. I think we talked about that a couple of shows ago. Is that 924C may or may not involve violence.
Right.
People seem to think that the First Step Act only excludes violent offenders. Man, it doesn't. It misses a lot of folks.
Right.
And if you're, you know, and if, and it comes down to that list of statutes and penalties, right? Mm-hmm. And, It doesn't say for 924C, it doesn't say, well, 924C, if there was serious bodily injury or if there was actual discharge of a firearm. It just says 924C. And when you read
that, by statute,
yeah, it's just 924C. And when you go into actual U.S. code and you read it, it may or it may not involve violence, you know. But if you go further down in the 924 statute, you find out that 924J actually says you committed 924C and someone died. But 924J, they're earning credit. Right. You know, there's a variety of cases
that. Right. And that's, you know, don't kill the messenger here, folks. I think, you know, part of that was like, oh, Susan Giddings believes that people should be helped. No, it's just, it's the numbers. We're looking at the numbers. We're looking at the facts. The facts are is that there's more people that could be positively impacted by the First Step Act that aren't being impacted, that are being left behind.
Or in the case of those with high and medium risk who are eligible. So we had a case this last week, finally worked his way down. And he got his year off, and there was no time for reentry. Now, there was a little snafu that we had to work out. But even separate from the snafu, when the time credit ran and he had dropped a low risk for the first time and he gets to apply his credit, mind you, it was only at the 10-day rate because of the legislative language that says when you can earn 15 days. So these folks that are medium and high risk, even if they work their way down, they don't get to maximize the amount of credit they could earn because the law has created these hurdles that parse out when they can get it. And then you have folks that just, they were hell on wheels for the first 25, 30 years of their life. And now they're sitting in federal prison and they get their high school diploma and they go to drug treatment. They do all the right things and they grow up in prison and they settle down and they go from being high, high to high, medium to medium, medium. And they run out of time. Even if one side drops and they go medium low, the way it's written, it's the higher, you know, it's right. It's the higher one becomes your overall level, and they just run out of time. But they're still trying, and I am a firm believer that if you are making positive progress, you should get credit for that. One of the things that we have advocated is this idea that high and medium risk folks can't apply their credit. One of the things you and I have been advocating for is, are you making progress? So at your initial classification and you get your initial pattern score and whatever it is, even if you are high, high in both categories, when you come back to team in 6 months, if you have demonstrated progress, you have, some of your points have come down. Maybe you're still high, high, but you know, you were up here high, and now you're here high, right? That's kind of weird. You've come down. You've made positive progress. You've done some programming. May not much yet. You've stayed out of trouble. And then tie that, keeping your credit, to clear conduct. You know, back in the old law days, when dinosaurs roamed the perimeter, an individual who started earning meritorious credit, which was above the statutory credit. If we think about statutory time like good conduct time, meritorious credit would be like time credits, right? And once you went into earning status, you stayed in earning status as long as you were at your facility and you were out of trouble. So if you went to SHU for any reason, your credit stopped. If you got transferred for any reason, you left the institution, your credit stopped. And then when you came back, and of course, meritorious credit was tied to clear conduct and work. So once you came back and you were back on your job and you were back working for 30 days, give or take, your case manager would do a form and send it in, and you would go back into earning status. This, the FSA, that's where the, you know, the FSA is so complex and so unnecessarily complex that, you know, the Bureau couldn't even integrate it into their existing infrastructure. If it had been tooled more like meritorious credit, more simplified, instead of just work in clear conduct, it was work in clear conduct and programming, right? If they had streamlined it, they could have built that on the existing infrastructure. Instead, they had to build a completely separate application that has to receive data, turn it around, process it, calculate time credits, and then import it back into the system to apply it to a release date. And then people want to wonder why it takes such a long time for changes to occur. Things like a conditional home confinement calculator would be super awesome for planning purposes, but they're focusing on making sure, in fact, one of the big changes that I don't know if we talked about or not, for folks in the community, they are now calculating time credits in the overnight hours so that folks in the community are, as soon as they're hitting their 30 days, they're getting that credit applied so that they're actually releasing on the conditional release date. Because we know the conditional release calculator is kind of generic and works on 30-day increments. So what's happening before was you had to wait until the monthly update. Well, because that population in the community is significantly smaller, 12, 13,000, 14,000, somewhere in that range, but a heck of a lot smaller than 156,000, they can run it nightly. And I know we've got folks in the institution who don't get halfway house and are like, well, when are they going to get it fixed for us? Part of the problem is they've got to be able to isolate the population. They cannot run the entire population every single night. It just sucks the processing resources and other things have to still operate. So they're looking at that. But it's because of the law created such a complex, sometimes conflicting information system that it just is sucking resources. And it's the administrative, and I know maybe from the incarcerated population and their families, they don't care about that administrative burden. But the administrative burden on the agency is drawing resources away from case managers and psychologists and other treatment specialists to provide programming because of this administrative, the paperwork side, the keying and the updating and the entering and all of this stuff. And are you eligible to apply, or you're eligible to earn, but you're not eligible to apply? And, you know, it's crazy.
And I think, you know, here recently, I won't name names, but you and I were approached by some government officials at a high level. And we gave them some feedback. And it's so, and I hope and I feel that they want to continue the dialogue and the discussion with us on how to fix this, because you and I are without the lens of a political agenda. First Step Act is designed to do this. Let's fix it so it does what it's supposed to do.
Yeah, absolutely.
There's no political agenda. Like, here it is. If you got something coming, you should be able to get it, right?
Yeah, and it's those highest risk folks,
right?
Those are the ones we want to incentivize. Right. Those are the ones that should be incentivized to a level that they would just have to be plain off their rocker not to take advantage of it, right? And that's important. You know, when you consider, you know, resource dollars, right? There was a column, shall not name names, that suggested that because the residential drug abuse program allows individuals to earn up to a year off based on completion, right? It's been in place for decades, that they should expand the criteria to the RDAP program to allow individuals who don't have a substance abuse history into the program so they could get the year off. Okay, aside from the sheer stupidity of that statement, it is a drug treatment program. The Bureau is one of the largest, if not the largest provider of residential drug abuse treatment in the country. People don't realize how many people are coming, either starting, complete, or participating or completing the drug abuse, the residential program. And that doesn't count the non-res program, right? How many people are coming through? Why would we take beds from individuals with substance abuse histories who need the treatment just so this person over here can get 12 months off their sentence? The point is for treatment. What I'd like to see is an expansion of completion credit. You know, I look at our penitentiaries. Penitentiaries, every penitentiary in the Bureau offers a challenge program. It is a residential program. It is modeled after the RDAP program in terms of it's a CPP program, CBT program. It's very identical in that, but it's for individuals at the penitentiary level, not necessarily with substance abuse issues, but dealing with some anger and some hostility and some violence issues, as you would expect to find in a penitentiary. They are seeing positive results, just like the RDAP program. I would like to see completion credit for early release benefit extended to them on the condition they remain free of serious misconduct for the remainder of their incarceration. Right. Why wouldn't we?
However, RDAP was linked to a political agenda. RDAP was the last vestige of the war on drugs. And then they had this whole thing going on with all these offenders coming in. We had crack powder. We had all kinds of stuff going on in the 90s, right? And RDAP was in its early, mid kind of heyday then, even in the late 90s. And so then that's why 3621E came into being, right? Out of those kind of war on drug policies, because there was so much in enforcement. Well, then what are you going to do right on the backside of that?
But it's so successful. If you look right at the RDAP graduates and you compare
sure
them to non-treatment.
I'm just saying,
yeah,
who's going to back, and look, hopefully there's somebody that would back these penitentiary folks or say, hey, we're looking at overall, helping recidivism rates for folks with a history of violence, let's say. And that's the cause, and here's this program, and here's this reward for this program and successful completion. So just, has to have that kind of 1, 2, 3 flow to it. Hey, and you know what? I hope we get there.
I would love to see more opportunities, not less. And it doesn't necessarily all have to be toward early release.
True.
You know, the problem we're having very quickly, I know we're getting close to the end of our time again, quickly, one of the problems with the FSA program is it is limiting early release credits to up to 1 year and then dumping massive amounts of credits to these extended 2+ year halfway house programs, halfway house of home confinement for 2+ years. We saw 26, 27 months recently. And that is not what pre-release placement was for. I would rather see, honestly, a cap on halfway house, extend the amount of early release credit an individual can have as a function of their sentence or their time served. So if they're looking at 10, 15, 20 years, and they're making good time, they're doing the programming, they're staying out of trouble. So what if you give them 18 months off your sentence or 20 months off your sentence?
Exactly. What do we have in old law? People hitting their third dates and whatever in
old
law.
Absolutely.
All day long.
And if there's extra credit still after that, after they've hit this, some function of their sentence and a year, put the rest of that time, give them the third door that they don't have right now.
Right.
And give them that remaining credit. Can be sent over, notified to probation, and then with the consent of probation and the courts, terminate supervised release early. Again, if you're doing well in supervision, you're doing everything you're supposed to be doing, why do we need to have someone on supervision for 5 years?
Right, exactly.
And again, give them that third door. So therefore, you've got credit being applied to early release, to halfway house home confinement and to early termination of supervised release. And I know we're out of time, so you're going to plug the book.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yep. Hold on.
I've got to plug the book. But, you know, we'll talk about this more in the coming weeks, obviously, because there's so much that can be done to make this program better.
All right. This is for your First Step Act, okay? Please have this sent into the institutions to your loved ones. Please read this, okay? Excellent information. You're about ready to go into federal prison and your pre-sentence report hasn't been written yet. You may want to look at this. You want to have your attorney purchase this book as a valuable resource, because that pre-sentence report is the Bible. It's the gospel. What you're going to be going by for the duration of your BOP custody.
Right. And the biggest bang for your buck is in pretrial, in that pretrial period, pre-sentence period. But we're seeing cases we've been working on this week where they made it past there, and now they're at a point where they're in the institution and some serious scoring, the way it's looking at scoring. And we're doing some specific advocating administrative remedy stuff to get those fixed. So.
Exactly. So we'll do a show where we go through some of our cases, and this was the presentation. This is what we did, and this is how it was the outcome. I think, you know, it's kind of fun to see that. And it's high level work. You know, it's a little bit, it's fun work. So go ahead.
So it's a kind of academic.
It's where, yeah, but it's
where we're having specific policies and language in the PSRs.
It is.
It is.
So it's awesome. And I'm glad that we're doing this work, and it's real important to a lot of folks. So I know it's kind of a interesting world out there in the milieu of consultants, but it is what it is. You know, we are who we are, but we're advocating for folks to get the most out of these policies, to get the most out of these laws, because that's why they passed them. Problem is, they passed a bunch of stuff and it's functionally broken. We're trying to fix it so it can get back to its operating goal and help a lot more people. So I just want to be painfully clear about our stance with that. That's our stance. You know, we're here to help, man. We're not keeping anybody in the joint longer. All right. So
absolutely.
Anywho, well, folks, it was another fantastic episode. You saw the books, and what else?
Any comments or questions can go into
comments or questions. Come to our Facebook group. Early release from federal prison, First Step Act, early release from federal prison. We have a YouTube channel called First Step Act. You can see some videos on the YouTube channel. Our Facebook group is probably close to 11,000, participants in there. So it's a great group. It's a public group. One of us has to let you in for admission, but it is a public group. And so we've, a lot of people get priceless information. It's a community.
Right. For families and people in the community, not the institution.
Right. Yeah. Please. If you're inside of a prison, please don't be using your bootleg illegal cell phone.
Please.
Please don't do that.
Yeah.
So we got the Facebook group. We got the YouTube channel. Our shows are also on LA Talk Radio, our home station here, latalkradio.com, and you can pull up our show, and all of our shows are right there. You can download them, you can view them, you can just download the audio, you can download the video. So you have all kinds of options there for every one of our shows. So that's free. You're not paying Nathan. It's free, totally free. So, all right then. Well, we're going to bid everybody a fantastic week. Be good. And ask those questions on the Facebook or YouTube. We'll get back to you next week.
Yep.
And we'll see you here next time on Around the Block, Federal Prison Authority Presents. So y'all take care.
Take care. Bye-bye.
You're listening to Federal Prison Authority Presents Around the Block with Bruce Cameron and Susan Giddings, only on LA Talk Radio.